Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sting, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Your name is very difficult to pronounce. Peggy Guggenheim. Do you ever stumble on it?
That's five G's, isn't it?
No, it has only four.
No, two.
Two and Peggy.
And three and
oh, three, nine. Yes, of course, because the
you
first one. Yeah. Do you think that great artists are great people, necessarily?
They're certainly much more interesting than business people.
The Guggenheims were one of those rich, glamorous American families, more like an institution. They made their fortune in the mining industry in the late 1800s. But there was one member of the family who wanted nothing to do with it. Peggy Guggenheim said, "My childhood was excessively unhappy. I have no pleasant memories of any kind." She felt like she was ugly. She was lonely. Growing up very rich, with a lot of expectations for how a woman was supposed to live. Expectations that didn't make sense to her, and never did. Eventually, she found Venice. "There's no normal life in Venice," she said. "Here, everything and everyone floats."
This is Peggy Guggenheim's grave. It says, "Here rests Peggy Guggenheim, 1898 to 1979. And then right next to it is another plaque that says, "Here lie my beloved babies, Cappuccino, Pagin, Peacock, Toro, Madame Butterfly, Baby, Emily, White Angel, Sir Herbert, Sable, Gypsy, Hong Kong, Salida." I think... well, those are her dogs.
I think she quickly became the so-called black sheep of the family.
This is her granddaughter, Carol Vale, who, like her grandmother, has made her life here in Venice.
I remember going around in her gondola with her gondolier and his striped shirt. But it wasn't just going around the canals in Venice. She would sometimes make me stop at a church and then go and look at paintings. And then I would have to go and look at the paintings, and then I would have to come back and report. I mean, she wasn't your usual grandmother, whatever usual means. but she was a little daunting.
Peggy Guggenheim is known for a lot of things. She's known as a champion of 20th century art, accumulating one of the greatest collections there is, and launching the careers of people like Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko. And she's known for being eccentric. As a reporter once said, even her sunglasses make news. In her memoirs, she writes a lot about her sex life. She had a lot of sex, and she had a lot of sex with famous people. When someone once asked her how many husbands she'd had, she replied, "Do you mean my own or other people's?" She's funny. But when she writes about Venice, it's different. Her tone changes. The cleverness seems to fall away. She writes, to live in Venice, or even to visit it, means that you fall in love with the city itself. There's nothing left over in your heart for anyone else. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love. Peggy Guggenheim's father, Benjamin Guggenheim, died on the Titanic. He'd been booked on another ship, but at the last minute bought a ticket for the maiden voyage of this fancy new boat. He and his assistant were woken up by an iceberg. Because they were first class, they were guaranteed a seat on the lifeboat. But when they reached the deck and saw that women and children were being left behind, Benjamin Guggenheim gave up his seat. He walked back to his room and put on his tuxedo. He was heard saying he wanted to die as a gentleman. A survivor later came to the Guggenheim family to tell them this story. Peggy was 13.
But I think she always missed him immensely, understandably. In fact, she writes in her autobiography that she was probably always looking for a father figure.
When she was 22, Peggy Guggenheim traveled to Cincinnati. She'd heard you could pay doctors to make you look better and got one of the first nose jobs in the country. The doctor had a row of plaster models of noses, and you just picked the one you wanted off the shelf. Something went wrong. She had the doctor stop halfway through. Afterwards, she said her nose swelled every time it rained. She got a job in a radical bookstore near Grand Central Station. Her mother didn't understand why she was working. Her rich aunts would come in and buy books by the yard to fill their bookshelves. They didn't seem to care what the books were. They just wanted to be certain they bought enough to fill the whole shelf. They brought a tape measure just to make sure. She didn't want to be a New York City socialite. She wanted to be friends with artists. She met a man named Lawrence Vail, the first man I knew who never wore a hat, she said. She describes him as a wild creature. When Lawrence Vail suggested they might go to his hotel room sometime, Peggy says she immediately stood up and put on her hat. That's how I lost my virginity, she writes. It was as simple as that. I soon found myself married, she writes, and felt extremely let down. Now that I had achieved what I thought so desirable, I no longer valued it so much. Lawrence Vail and Peggy Guggenheim had two children, Sinbad and Pegeen. But the marriage wasn't happy, and they divorced. I've always found husbands much more satisfactory after marriage than during, she says. She then fell in love with the writer Samuel Beckett, and he encouraged her to think about art and what money can do for artists in new ways. Here she is, speaking in 1969.
Well, I didn't know anything about contemporary art, but I knew a lot about all other art. And he said one should be interested in art of one's time. And made me think it was sort of a moral duty.
Oh, so did it have the stigma of a moral duty? I mean, was it a bit of a chore at first?
No, it was very difficult at first, but it wasn't a chore. It was always fascinating.
Beckett encouraged her to see art as a living thing, to focus on today and tomorrow, right now, when we could. She began to use her inheritance to buy works of art from up-and-coming modern artists. Here's her granddaughter, Carol Vail.
She was literally armed with a checklist of names of artists, all living artists. And she diligently went to studios and galleries, but mostly to studios, artists, to start purchasing for her collection of modern art, something which she did very vigorously in Paris around 1939, 1940, which were the heydays in many ways of Peggy's collecting.
Were you an impulsive buyer, or were you very calculating?
I was an impulsive buyer, often much too much, so.
But surely your impulse must have served you well at that time as well.
Both for good and for bad. Yes.
She writes, having plenty of time and all the museum funds at my disposal, I put myself on a regimen to buy a picture a day. When she went to Picasso's studio, he told her she must be in the wrong place. Madam, he said, you'll find the lingerie department on the second floor. Support for This Is Love comes from Shopify. If you've ever had a dream of starting your own business, Shopify can be a great place to start. Shopify is an online platform that lets you sell things online and in person and makes it incredibly easy to accept all kinds of different payment methods, figure out how to charge taxes, how to charge shipping, and get detailed top-down views on how your sales are going. Some of your favorite brands already rely on Shopify to power their online shops, like Rothy's, Brooklinen, and Allbirds. But you don't need to be well-established to use Shopify. They'll help you at every stage of your business and have tools to help people who are just starting out, like their AI-powered tool, Shopify Magic, or their built-in marketing tools that can help you create and analyze campaigns. Shopify grows with your business, no matter how far or big you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thisislove, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thisislove now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/thisislove. Support for This Is Love comes from Quince. Lately, I've been less interested in having a lot of clothes and more interested in having fewer things that are well-made and will last me a long time. Quince offers well-made clothing like corduroy pants, 100% organic cotton fisherman crew sweaters, and really beautiful cashmere at a more reasonable price. Quince's items cost 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They partner directly with top factories and, according to Quince, only work with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. One of the things I got was a denim button-down shirt that has hundreds of great reviews. It comes in denim and chambray, feels very soft, and looks great. I also ordered their best-selling cashmere trouser sock in a few colors and even gave a pair to my mother. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/thisislove for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/thisislove to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/thisislove. In 1940, Peggy Guggenheim was living in Paris, buying art from young people who had become some of the most famous artists in the world. When the Nazis invaded France, she worried about her paintings. A friend suggested she ask the Louvre to hide her collection in their vault, but they declined. They said what she'd collected wasn't worth it.
The Louvre changed their mind, said they weren't worth saving.
And the Louvre was sure that Mondrian wasn't worth saving and Picasso wasn't worth saving?
Exactly.
Oh, how extraordinary. I bet they're sorry now.
Well, the things are saved anyhow, in spite of them, so it doesn't really matter, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't, and I think that their saving must have taken some doing, though. How did you get them over to the United States?
First of all, I had to get them out of Paris before the Germans came, and all these pictures were supposed to be degenerate art, according to Mr. Hitler. And I wouldn't leave until I got the pictures out, but finally, a very lucky man arranged the whole thing for me and sent the whole thing to New York. As household objects. We had to send sheets and blankets and casseroles and an old car I had, and it was all shipped off and got to New York quite...
Right there in the middle of the war with
right
the submarines
there.
And
yes,
everything.
She followed her art back to New York, hiring a Pan Am Clipper airplane to take her, her children, and her new boyfriend, the artist Max Ernst, to the United States. In New York, she opened a gallery called Art of the Century, where she showed the work of Salvador Dali, Frida Kahlo, William de Kooning, Mark Rothko, Robert Motherwell, Leonora Carrington.
I started all off.
You started it all off, and you found Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, and de Kooning never had an exhibit or Clifford Still?
Yes, they did. Clifford Still had an exhibit.
Never before you, though.
Oh, no, no. These are all first exhibits.
I think she understood immediately that it was her duty to help young artists, and it was her duty to help them along with their careers, put on exhibitions. And more often than not, these were not successful commercial ventures. So she would often buy a work or two from the artist in order not to disappoint the artist.
She had a show entirely of women artists, something no one else was doing. Georgia O'Keeffe declined the invitation because, she said, she didn't want to be categorized as a woman painter. Time magazine refused to cover the exhibition because the art critic felt there were no important women artists. Salvador Dali's wife, Gala, suggested to Peggy that she settle down.
Now, what did she mean? And you think she's right?
I should have had one person in my life whom I just looked after and whose interests I furthered. And, you know, I suppose the way she did for Dali, she thought I should have had a husband or a lover or somebody whom I concentrated on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you did, didn't you?
Well, never exclusively. I never gave up collecting and running my gallery and looking after artists. When I was married to Max Ernst, even I continued. Probably didn't help the marriage very much, but I continued nevertheless.
But do you think that you have sacrificed anything to art?
Yes, I've given up all my life to it since I began, but I think I got a lot out of it.
Yes.
I was well rewarded.
Indeed. Was it really a sacrifice at all?
Yes. It's great. In a way, it's a great sacrifice and worry. And I had to put an awful lot of work into it, an awful lot of worry, an awful lot of responsibility.
Do you think collecting this work was a form of companionship for her?
It was a mission. It was a mission. It was her work.
This is Francine Prose. She wrote a biography of Peggy Guggenheim called The Shock of the Modern.
She didn't want the life that her family imagined for her. She didn't want to be, you know, a society matron having teas and having, like, kind of china and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so she became a dealer and a collector, and that was her work, and that was her life, and that was her mission.
In 1948, she took some of her favorite works to Venice to exhibit at the Venice Biennale. It was the first time Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko had been shown outside of the United States. She fell in love with Venice. She called it her dream city. And shortly after, she packed it all up and moved there.
I think she was more at peace there than she'd been. I think even though Art of the Century, her gallery, was so successful, isn't quite the word. I mean, so formative and so influential and so important. She had unhappy experiences there. I mean, her marriage to Max Ernst was a disaster. And I think when she went to Venice, she could kind of reinvent herself and just, I think she knew it was someplace that she could be happy. Also, I think it was a kind of a dream of hers to own a palazzo.
But Peggy didn't want a palazzo which was overly decorated. She needed something relatively plain, clean white lines. And she came across Palazzo Venier de Leoni, which had been inhabited by some extraordinary women before her, by the Marchesa Maria Luisa Casati at the beginning of the 20th century, then by an English countess. And then for a few years, it had been virtually abandoned. But when Peggy saw it, she saw this one-story white building, but which was covered in ivy. And I think she thought that these pure, relatively pure white lines were perfect for her collection of modern art. There was a lot of work to be done to the palazzo, I am sure. There were probably remnants of some kind of frescoes, but as the building had never been finished, it was still relatively, relatively plain.
It doesn't look like any of the palazzi around it. I mean, it's spare. It looks sort of neo-Grecian. It doesn't have the sort of Renaissance, I mean, not Baroque look of so many of the others. And it lent itself kind of naturally as a place to show modern art, which might have looked more out of place in a more kind of old-fashioned structure.
And then she opens her collection, her museum, her home, several times a week to the public in the afternoon, which I think was a fantastic thing to do.
Will you describe the sculpture in front of the palazzo on the water there?
Yeah, it's a guy on a horse. And I mean, the legend is, and I'm never quite sure if it's true or not, that the guy has a detachable penis that she would put on and take off, you know, depending on the occasion. But again, I'm not sure if that's an urban legend or not. I mean, I have a feeling it might be, but that's what one hears.
Well, the urban legend I heard is that she actually had different sizes.
I never heard that.
Depending on her mood, she changed the size.
You know, what I heard was that when she knew there'd be boatloads of church people or nuns coming by, she would put it on just for the occasion.
She lived across the canal from the head of the local government, who said, "When I see Mrs. Guggenheim sunbathing on the roof, I know springtime has come." An Italian socialite once told Peggy, "If only you would throw all those awful pictures in the Grand Canal, you'd have the most beautiful house in Venice."
I'm just overwhelmed by what she accomplished and how way ahead of her time she was, and the kind of vision she had. And, you know, I mean, when you go to the collection, you can't not notice what she accomplished. But I still think that she's undervalued in ways, you know, because she was a woman and because she was so free in certain ways.
The Peggy Guggenheim collection was more formally converted into a museum in 1980, the year after she died. Carol Vail is the director, overseeing her grandmother's legacy. After working for 20 years as a curator at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, she came here to the same house that she would spend time in as a child. And she says she loves coming to work in this place.
And, I mean, I remember, for example, sleeping in a bedroom surrounded by some rather fearsome-looking paintings, like surrealist paintings with some very strange-looking figures by Max Ernst, or really quite terrifying for a young girl, a teenage girl. And even just spending time in the palazzo, I mean, eating in the dining room surrounded by early Cubist paintings was really something quite extraordinary.
But it is a much more intimate setting, isn't it, than the kind of wide spaces?
Yes, it's a home. It's much more a home than a museum.
And yet the public does come to your home in Venice.
Yes, they come twice a week.
And what do you do when they're there?
I hide on the roof and take a sunbath. I protect myself.
You protect yourself. I think that there is the sense that Peggy Guggenheim must be mad to buy all these wild paintings, you know? I remember people talking about modern art when I was in school as being something that only very strange people were interested in. You must have had relatives who said, "Why are you buying this art?"
Yes, but none of that made a difference to me. I just went ahead and do what I thought was interesting.
Do you choose where your paintings hang in your house?
Oh, I mean, yes.
You do all the installation?
I have to, yes. I'm my own curator.
As Francine Prose notes, in photographs of Peggy here at her palazzo, she seems to get more beautiful as she gets older. White hair suits her. Her large earrings. Her long, sometimes theatrical, metallic dresses. Dogs in her lap. Giving a sort of half smile. Peggy Guggenheim once described herself as a lone wolf. She writes, "It took me a long time to liberate myself." This Is Love is created by Lauren Spohr and me. Nadia Wilson is our senior producer. Audio mix by Michael Raphael and Rob Byers. Julian Alexander makes original illustrations for each episode of This Is Love. You can see them at thisislovepodcast.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter at This Is Love Show. This Is Love is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. We're a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collection of the best podcasts around. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, is this the Peggy Guggenheim Museum?
This is the Peggy Guggenheim, yes.
Hello, I'm a reporter doing a story on the history of the museum, and I'm just wondering about the Marini sculpture out front and whether there's any part of it that's detachable.
You mean the Marini on the Grand Canal?
Yes.
Once, just really many, many years ago when Peggy was alive, there was a part that could be removed, but not now. It's fixed.
So when Peggy was alive, you could remove it?
Yeah, but now it's fixed, so you cannot remove it anymore. Oh, the man.
The part of the...
Okay.
Yes. Yes, thank you very much. I think we... But it's stuck on there now. It can't be taken off now.
No.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Radiotopia.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.